but I think we should make it be known that there's a gap.
So I want to recognize Laura, you're right in my visual field defect. See, you're going to have to kick the table or something to get my attention. I'm sorry, I haven't called you.
I think another gap would be in the overuse or inappropriate use of atypical antipsychotics in patients with dementia, an area obviously that CMS in their recently announced behavioral health initiative is a strong focus, and TQA last week just endorsed a measure in that area.
Excellent. Thank you. Sean?
Yeah, I just echo Richard's point, but get us out of being on a death panel issue, which I think is problematic. But I think thinking of coming back, Richard, and just thinking about setting goals of care, matching treatments to goals in the setting of serious illness, gets into all the end-of-life choices and in terms of the overutilization and serious illness, which will lead down that pathway and doesn't put you on a death panel.
Okay. So let me at this point say that we've got to kind of go back over the whole afternoon and open up for public comments in the room. We've been kind of marching through this, and we've got to catch up with anybody that we're missing from public comments.
Okay.
And, I'm sorry?
One more quick question or comment about the gaps, the choosing wisely. We're both ONC and CMS are currently developing some measures under that choosing wisely frame. And so that's just an FYI that we're trying to look to those kinds of things as possible new measures for this particular space.
Super. I think that's a great ask. And can we open up the phone line for any public comments?
Yes, sir. At this time, if you'd like to make a comment, please press star then the number one on your telephone keypad.
This is Foster. I'm not part of the public, but part of the group, and I just wanted to get in one other gap area, if that's okay, Frank.
Jump in.
The area related to cardiac services, and particularly PCI, some work that we're doing, and I think others are doing, looking at the current recommendations by the professional societies for appropriateness, finding anywhere between 13 and 20-some-odd percent of PCIs may be done for indications that may be, there may be no indications. So I think I didn't see it on the list. I didn't hear as someone mention it, although maybe I missed it. And I think there's not currently a standardized measure, but in terms of a gap area, or I would frame it as an area of real opportunity in terms of the frequency, I think that that's an area that might be of some interest going forward. Thanks.
We'll keep that on our radar. We do have a family that is in the cardiac area, but so we can keep that on our cross-family work group. So we've got a cousin over there in the family. We've got a comment in the room.
Hello, this is Lisa Brooks-Taylor from the American Health Information Management Association, and we'd like to voice our concern regarding the ramp-up costs and administrative burden of implementing all these measures. We urge that as the measures are being selected, that it be expedited, that these go through the NQF process to have them converted to e-specification measures. As we have heard, there is a growing concern that measures do not readily convert to e-measures. We've also heard comments about coding today, and the rules for coding are very strict, the official guidelines. Sometimes there are things in the medical record and the electronic health record that are captured that we cannot pick up through coding. I would like to suggest that the measures regarding the maternity and perinatal may be low-hanging fruit and readily converted to e-measures, because many of the data elements those measures call upon are entered in a structured data format in an electronic health record. And out of all the measures we're talking about, I think those measures we're very concerned about due to the volume, and that the facilities have not typically collected data on this population set, and due to the volume and the fact that facilities are not ramped up in this area, I think it would be prudent to look at those measures. I think some of those measures that were claim-based in that area, once you move to a specification, may take care of some of the concerns that Andrea was bringing to light. And so we urge that those be expedited either through that three-year maintenance process that NQF has or an ad hoc process. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Some more public comments. All right. So we are about to move into the complications and related mortality group. Before we do, you have a yoga moment. You may stand, get something to drink, do something biological, and then return. All right. If we would all start to head back to our chairs. So we are moving toward the final from our discussion guide, and we'll be moving into the complications-related mortality measures. And for that discussion, we've got Ron, Helen, and Randy. And Helen, do you want to go first?
No, I
haven't. Oh, okay. Well, Ron, please do.
Okay, this can be very painful or very easy.
Mortality?
In the Excel spreadsheet, there are 42 measures or so, broken down by a number of disease sites, a number of special populations, and you name it, all other different categories of stuff. Lindsay et al. Has sorted that out into three things, you see, on your on the discussion handout. The bottom two, which are kind of a misnomer, the Stewart is Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, they actually apply to all age groups. 352 is the percentage of people who died with a complication while they're in the hospital, and 353 to get around the rapid discharge handoff that people did. Because of that was people who died with a complication within 30 days from admission due to a failure of rescue care. The top one is sponsored by ARC, and that is probably can be wrapped into one into the other two in that this one defines certain surgical DRGs and then says basically did you die of a certain complication. So I would strongly support all three or at least the bottom two out of those three because of the third one possibly being duplicative. I would not suggest going into the list of the 38 others and picking them out one by one by one.
Randy?
Okay, thank you. A little bit redundant here, I suppose. It's not like everything else we're doing is not important. It is, but this is one area in which I think it's I think we can and should have a real impact. We should look to go to end up with as few gaps as possible. I graduated medical school in 1972. I have seen people die of medical complications, of avoidable deaths through medical complications. But I would note that I don't think I've seen anyone die unexpectedly of a blood transfusion complication. Where we have always had a very robust process in place to prevent that. So I think we have opportunity here, and I'm really looking to see as wide a net as possible. I agree with 352 and 353, and I think again if this is looking at deaths top down, starting with mortality and capturing them all, not including those recent discharges. It is, in fact, facility-based. I also am inclined to agree that the 351 is probably a subset of 352. I'm not certain of it, but I agree that I believe it is, in fact, the case. I would also think that 352 in particular can be made to apply perhaps some modification to skilled nursing facilities, and that should be considered also. Looking at 531 and 532, which is looks like the same kind of thing except separately for adults and pediatrics, this is looking at the same thing but looking at it bottom up, basically, looking at complications and looking at complications that result in mortality, and there are a great number of them, and there have to be, because you have to try and make as inclusive a list as possible and try and specify as many of them as possible to make it work. I think if we're going to cast a really wide net, I would be inclined to try and include 3.1 and 3.2. Admittedly, this is going to be difficult. You're going to come up with a lot of compliance will be difficult, but there are a lot of items here to identify. I'm not certain we can capture without the gaps. Looking at mortality and backing up, without looking at the without identifying the percentages of these complications that rise up to mortality. So I would like to try and include 3.1 and 3.2 also.
And just before we open up to the big group, I just have one question on 5.1, 5.2, 5.3, if those couldn't serve as a bundle, not necessarily a composite, but reporting all three. 5.1, 5.2, 5.3. So there's an all mortality, there's a surgical serious surgical mortality, and then there's the within 30 days from admission. No, they're all. The 5.1 would be a subset of 5.2, 5.3, and it would give you the surgical.
Yeah, I mean, we would want to capture the surgical mortality, but I think we agree that that would be a subset of all.
Open. General thoughts, Richard.
Yes. So, I think if we review the technical paper, 52 and 53 are very surgically oriented. I don't know if it's entirely, but I think it's not entirely. It's extremely heavily surgically oriented, which is fine. It's easier to figure out complications in the surgical population. I would like also to cast a wide net, and I think it's really important that we understand and know which institutions are having more complications than expected. My concern with these particular measures is I don't know if we're quite there yet for public reporting. My big concern is whether or not the methodology incorporates the present on admission flag. And I've been on their website, and I've been going through their technical paper, and the most recent one I can find is 2009, which is really just when the POA flag was coming out. And, you know, it does make a difference because we have looked, and hopefully this will be published soon, at many of these so-called complications, and even if you look at the 9-9 complications, a lot of these things are present on admission, so you can't just simply throw it into the bucket. And my concern is, you know, is with false positives. So I'd like to know if there's any data on false positive rate of these measures. And, you know, I, for one, would like to know which hospitals are causing complications if I'm going to go into a hospital, but I don't want to have a measure there that's giving me a false positive and then actually directing me somewhere else. So it could be harmful unless we know we're really measuring what we want. So I'd like to know about the present on admission flag and the false positives before we move on to adopt those for public reporting. And then I guess since the microphone is open, I dislike the composites. One, for the reason is I don't believe the composite number is actionable. And two is if you look into the individual components, a lot of these we had trouble with yesterday, the iatrogenic pneumothorax, the laceration. I think some of these we were less than thrilled with. And so creating a composite, which includes
measures we didn't want to look at individually doesn't seem, it doesn't seem helpful to me.
So that's the note I have from Lindsay. We didn't like those yesterday. So what makes today different?
Well, I think what makes it different is the failure to rescue. This is not about the complications. It's about the mortality from the complications.
No, these are the last two, not the first three.
Right. Well, no, but it's for the purpose of seeing which of the you will create data which will show the percentage that results in mortality. And, you know, and maybe we do have to reexamine these individually back to the drawing board. But this is what gives us the opportunity to look at Spotify. It's some measure like this.
Like the composite.
And maybe we have to reexamine the components of the composite since we can find, you know, we should be able to find some that we could use.
Right. I mean, we didn't like components of the composites yesterday. That's my point. So if we're putting together bad data, we're really not going to get better.
Yep.
Amy?
I'm looking at a slide from an ARC webinar they did on the presence on admission flag. If you use their software, it is used in the risk adjustment for every single ARC measure. That's all of their quality indicators. For this particular measure, though, it is not used in the measure specifications.
Which measure are you talking about?
The PSI, so the 0351.
Okay. Say again, then, what's your point?
It is not used in the measure specification, so it is not used to define the numerator, denominator, or exclusions. But when you calculate this measure using the ARC software, the present on admission flag is used in the risk adjustment.
Bill, are you on the phone?
Dr. Conway is online.
I am on the phone.
Did you have a comment?
No.
Okay.
I was just, at least the three measures you're debating here, our committee didn't review, 51, 52, and 53.
But, Bill, the other one that they're looking at is 351, which is the death in among surgical inpatients. Oh, wait a minute. I was wrong. Bill is right. He didn't review that last week. Somebody
yeah. And the only other part of the discussion I caught, the composite, we reviewed the elements of the composite, and it's like the discussion yesterday. A lot of those elements, while they did pass, I wouldn't say they passed with enthusiasm.
So staying on the first page of 351, 5253, is there consensus to take all three of these? Seeing a nodding ahead.
I would disagree.
And which, you would take none of them, or?
I would take none of them, unless I need to know. If you're going to direct me to a hospital based upon this information, which is what I think we're trying to do, I would like to know the extent to which these things provide true positives and true negatives. I'm concerned with false positives, especially if these algorithms don't use the POA flag. And so while I think it's an admirable thing to do, and I think we should use this as a screening tool and continue to develop the measure, I think until I know the answer to that, I wouldn't recommend putting it out there for public reporting.
Any other comments?
The first measure does use the POA flag. That's the question I was answering.
Yes.
You're talking about the 351, 353?
Yeah.
Again, I would respond that it's the mortality and the failure to rescue, which failure to rescue can't be present on it. Well, you could, but you're talking about failure to rescue within that institution.
Well, we're assuming there's present on admission.
Complication.
But then there's a complication that led to a failure to rescue.
Right, but I think what we're measuring here is the death from the complication rather than the incidence of the complication.
Right. That's true. Lance?
Looking at PSI 4, which is 351, I think the key here is that this looks in the denominator at the surgical discharges. It's looking at serious complications, but they should be treatable. So I'm just wondering if clinically, if you're going to perform surgery on a patient, you probably know in advance if they have any one of these serious complications. You're probably making a decision whether or not to do surgery or not based on whether or not they have a complication. So I think that's probably why they're not looking at a present admission code for the complications, but they're probably using it in risk adjustment. So I think we kind of have to keep that in mind too, which might make this, you know, a better measure or an okay measure.
Anne-Marie?
For the other two, 52 and 53, do we know if they have present on admission factored in some way? Just wondering. Okay.
Looking now. Andrew?
We already have fairly robust mortality metrics. Where are those? Those don't make this because they're not safety measures. And so, to my mind, I don't see that these have flaws that Richard has described, and I don't see that these add anything over those other mortality metrics that are pretty robust and well-defined and et cetera, et cetera. So I was just looking for the measure specs. I'm not finding them, but where are the other mortality measures, the 30-day mortality measures? They don't make this list. They make some other list. They're not part of safety. I'm missing the boat here.
So I think most of them are condition-specific, which would be why they would go to the cardiovascular, diabetes, or others.
But wasn't there an all-cause one that was in development? It's still in development.
No, so there are two all-cause measures that just were endorsed hospital-wide. Readmission measures, but not mortality.
Not mortality.
Yeah.
Hello?
Well, I'll just say, if you survey patients, this is the most important thing to them. This is what most people are seeing is fatigue statistics in hospitals, but because it goes to issues of staffing, of training of staff, of attentiveness of staff, of you know, what is happening to the people who are on the wards after surgery. And I think this is really the one thing that patients would want measured. It's certainly the one thing that I would want measured about a hospital.
So just my own view of these, I hate using percentages for doing these mortality projections. I like looking at ODE ratios for this, risk-adjusted, patients admitted, and I would expect survival to be X, and if it's not, then that's what I think the public wants to know. When it's just a percentage, if I'm the high-risk hospital in the community, I'm going to have a higher percentage, period. I mean, it's just, even though these risk adjustment engines are out there, they're relatively primitive, and when put up against true standard ODE clinical registries, they fall down. And so I worry more about misinforming the public with these measures. These are high priority measures. We definitely need these measures. The public deserves to know them, but they deserve to know them in the most meaningful way. And it gets to this issue of the false positives or the true positives against the false negatives that are out there. Barbara?
Yeah, you know, these are, according to this chart, the first one is reported at the facility level. The second two are reported at the regional health plan or integrated system level. They're not facility specific.
No, there are facilities in there. Facilities in the list.
Oh, I see it. I got it. Okay.
But you're right. It's broader than facilities.
And I actually think there's some substantial utility. Letting a community know that its hospitals aren't doing very well and letting the hospitals in the community know that they're not doing very well, because it seems to me it's an impetus for them to have a collaborative. I'm really trying to think of how do we get to improvement And I think reporting this data, let me leave aside the facility issue, but reporting this data at that level has enormous, I think it has significant value, and I'd really like to argue for it. The issue with the facility is, you know, it's the same as always the issue when the numbers are small, ratios get really unintelligible. You know, you could go from 1 to 2 or 2 to 4 or whatever. So I always worry about that with this kind of data. Although it might be worth having incidence reports as opposed to ratio reports at the facility level. But anyway, that's...
Randy?
A couple more comments. You know, it goes without saying that this needs to be risk, that this definitely, this clearly needs to be risk-adjusted, and risk-adjusted as well as possible, and preferably expressed as a ratio. And I think in that context, we should do this. I also wanted to mention one possible caution, but I certainly wouldn't want this used to discourage palliative care. And it might possibly carry that kind of danger. I don't really think palliative care does, in fact, increase mortality. In fact, what evidence we have suggests just the opposite. But I would want this done in such a way that it would not be that no hospital CEO would see this as discouraging palliative care. And the other point is I would try and move this a little bit beyond the hospital, the few hospitals I can. Clearly, the biggest, you know, we're focused on acute facilities because that's where the money is, I suppose. Here, that's where the problem where it can be attacked. But I think there's opportunity here in nursing homes also.
Bill?
I have a question. I understand that concerns have been raised about these related to methodological, at least possible methodological issues, and the danger of false positives, and questions about whether things like a DOA flag are included and appropriate risk adjustment. I feel, as part of this group, not very qualified to comment on that because I'm not familiar with the specifics of the measure. In this, I tend to rely on the endorsement process, as those, my understanding is those are exactly the kinds of issues that are wrestled with through the endorsement process, and we have subject matter experts come in and clinical experts come in and wrestle with these things, and if there's something that's not measuring the right stuff or comes out with results that with lots of false positives or where there is inadequate risk adjustment, then they don't make it through the endorsement process. So help me out here about whether we're trying to take on a task that's already been done somewhere else. I'm just worried about
that. We were in a discussion while Heidi was checking on spec. So if you're asking the spec question, let's go back to Heidi.
Well, actually, I wasn't asking the spec question. I was asking a process question about where's the right forum to have this discussion. Because I just don't feel qualified to be part of it, not being a clinical expert. And we have a mixture of folks here, some of them have deep clinical expertise and some who don't, like myself. So I'm really asking more of a question about what are these issues usually addressed in the endorsement process? If we have questions, it's appropriate to ask them. I'm not sure we should be saying thumbs up, thumbs down on whether these are good, whether the specs are right, and whether it's the right measurement if we don't have all that information and it's not being done with a process to address it here.
I respond directly to that.
Sure.
Because I've sat at the other table as well at the NQIP endorsement process. And as we go and deliberate, we look at the scientific validity of the measure. My question always is, valid for what? Some of these are really valid for screening tools or could be valued for improvement. And when I ask the question, what about suitability for public reporting, I'm told, and Tom will correct me if I'm wrong, it's the applications group that decides that. It's the NQF work groups and process that decide scientific validity and whether or not, you know, the measure has met a basic hurdle of usability, but its application is basically for this group to decide. And I, because I don't know how good these measures are, in terms of their sensitivity and specificity and false positives, I'm not sure I'm ready to apply it to public reporting. So we can't keep kicking the tennis ball across the net. And I think we have to decide if it's applicable. And Tom and NQF can correct me if I'm wrong.
So I think you're both right that endorsement and selection are related and inform one another. There are certain things that are decided in endorsement that have to do with scientific acceptability and also the important feasibility and usability. On the selection side, we're really looking for the best measures for various purposes. So we rely on endorsement to say these are good measures. We think really everything that's endorsed on this list we would probably all agree are good measures that have met a certain level of scrutiny. The question then becomes, and why we're sitting here talking about what should be in the family of measures, are what are the best measures for the accountability applications, basically. We're also assuming that those are measures that are going to drive improvement because that's a part of what we're doing here. So, it's up to us to think about the applications based on the fact that we know these are good measures from the endorsement process. Which ones would we say are the best for improvement, transparency, and value? That's what we have to determine.
Dana?
So I think, I agree that these types of outcome measures are important and we should be, reporting these out to the public and demonstrating transparency. But listening to this conversation in terms of how this is expressed, meaning a percentage versus a ratio, and unless some of these questions can be answered and possibly gaps, such as do they incorporate the POA flag and false positives and defining out serious versus treatable complications, I just don't know that we'd be doing justice to our public to report them out as they stand now. And we could be, again, reporting out information that would redirect patients away from a hospital to another facility that would actually be of lesser quality, potentially. So that's kind of my stance on it at this point.
Andrea?
Yeah. So 351 is a different developer than 352 and 53, so slightly different. So for 351, I look through and I think it'd be worthwhile for us to go back and confirm this with the developer, but I don't see present on an admission used for this. They look at secondary diagnoses, et cetera, to determine the numerator. But again, sometimes that was last submitted to us, the full spec. In 2010, it's 2012 now, so let me go back and confirm that. For 352 and 353, it's the same thing. I don't see present on admission. I also, the testing doesn't give false positives. They do give testing, but it's not specific to that, so I think we can go back and ask them if ARC and Children's Health the same question and see if we can get it for you. I just don't have it in the materials that's provided. There is risk assessment, yes, in all of them.
It says the 52 and 53 are just for surgery, for general surgery or general investment.
That's correct, yes.
52 and 53? So
they're general ortho and vascular.
So all three of these are surgical.
Let me double check one more time. Mm-hmm.
If they're risk-adjusted surgical patients, would they need a POA?
Yeah.
Would that be relevant?
It's a big problem.
What would be present on admission?
Dead bowel.
Dead what?
Dead bowel.
Oh, dead bowel.
You come in with dead bowel, you open them up, they're dead. You close them up, they die. You get hit by this.
And the risk adjustment would not capture that?
There's no present on admission.
That's why I think we need to go back and confirm it with the developer to be sure.
And I'm looking at the technical specs for PSI 4, the 2012 technical specs, and I don't see a POA code in there used for these complications. But then, again, going back to my previous comments, I'm not sure if this metric was designed to capture these complications present on admission. What they do exclude is that these complications are in the principal diagnosis code. That's kind of a screen for the suitability of doing a surgery on patients that have these coming in the door. It's kind of a pseudo POA check in my mind.
Richard?
So that's, a good intuition, and it was mine as well. But when we looked at the data from our database, you'll find things out not in the primary code, but are things like complications of a device. And you would say that's clearly a complication, but it was actually present on admission. So the patients coming to the hospital with a whole host of things, and some of them are complications that may have occurred in a previous stay, and it may be counterintuitive, but even those 9-9 complication of, you cannot assume they're complications. And that is why I think the POA flags added a lot, and we need to take advantage of that.
I guess I'll respond to that. You know, I think that this indicator is only looking at 5 or 6 treatable complications. It's DVT, PE, it's pneumonia, sepsis, shock or cardiac arrest, GI hemorrhage, acute ulcer. So just those 6 serious but treatable complications. That's the key.
Richard?
For me, this one is similar to the adverse drug event ones, in the sense that, kind of going back to a comment you made earlier, if you have a chip and you only could spend one, where would you spend it? And as it relates to, you know, the overall topic here in terms of risk, it seems to me like this one's pretty high. Death is clearly an important kind of complication that I think we need to take into account. However, there may be a bit of a black hole here also, you know, in terms of measurement. And I personally don't know enough about the measure itself to, you know, rule whether there's whether it needs to be refined or doesn't need to be refined. I mean, the more I hear gives me a little more comfort, actually, in learning some things. And get your comment in terms of some people that are going to come in to the hospital. There's clearly a problem here in terms of measurement. So I would be inclined to have this pretty high in terms of priority to address it. I'm not quite sure in terms of whether this specific or these specific measures are the ones. I just have some uncertainty about that. It also for me raises the issue of the importance of risk adjustment, not only for this one, but for all of the different measures that we have. There's a significant shift that occurs when we move use of measurement from continuous quality improvement to public reporting and comparative evaluation. And, when you simply have a set of measures that you use to benchmark yourself to get better, that's a good thing. And you don't have to worry about risk adjustment as much in relation to that. But suddenly when there's a public comparison of whether you're doing well or not, then adverse selection, comes into play, and maybe more importantly, specialization comes to play. People won't want to specialize in the things that are really most important to address, unless it's risk-adjusted. And so I think this becomes one for me that's important to do everything we can to perfect. At the same time, address the issue of risk adjustment in a very proactive way, so that there really is fair kind of comparison going on.
Anne-Marie?
I'd really like to second that, and I don't I mean, working with a hospital system, we're depending, I mean, we get lots of statistics sometimes on mortalities, and the devil is in the detail of that risk adjustment and exactly how they risk adjust and what they put into that. And while I can understand we don't want to pick apart the metrics that have been used, this one in particular, I think, because it does have such an impact on the public, I think if you're saying that this hospital, more people are dying than the other hospitals, and that does have such an emotional, I think, impact on patients, you have to be really a little bit more careful, I think. And I think the risk adjustment here, when you include things on admission, slight changes in this. Most hospitals don't have high mortality rates. I mean, lots of patients dying in-house. So slight changes in how you risk adjust can have really big impacts. So I just, and again, the more high-tech some of the hospitals are, the more they take on the seriously ill, you know, the more they can be hit with some of these. So I'm just saying I think this one, although I don't like going back and nitpicking on what was done, I think this one we really should be a little cautious on and be careful. On the other hand, I do think that the concept of dealing with complications that end up in mortality is a really good one. And I think if we could get a good thing for it, I'd endorse it. But I just think we have to be really careful about this one.
Barbara, is yours on? Sean?
Stop me if this is, you know, sort of beating a dead horse. But two issues that I have related to this specific measure, and to come back with to the development process. The first is real concerns about the POA missing from the risk adjustment. But the second is, in an outcome, you know, speaking as a health services researcher, as an outcome that's rare, which is mortality in hospitals, hopefully, in an outcome which is even rarer, which is mortality directly attributable to these specific complications, what it means is that we're going to, those risk-adjusted models are not going to identify the outliers very well. So the outliers and the people that we're very worried about, the people that Frank's talking about, are not going to be picked up in those risk-adjusted models. For a small hospital or somebody that doesn't have a huge volume, one, two, three, four, five of those are going to have a huge impact on percentages. And somebody's going to get dinged for that because they simply fall out of the risk adjustment. They were never those characteristics were never included in the models. And similarly, for the larger hospitals that have a very select patient population that also may be at higher risk coming in for a postoperative complication, again, those people are not going to be appropriately adjusted because of the small sample in which the models were developed. And if we're moving, as Richard says, from quality improvement to accountability, and because of the valence that mortality has on the public and hospitals, I want to make sure that that mortality risk-adjusted model is absolutely perfect, and I'm not sure that even in the best science this one would be.
So I think you're right in the framework of where we are. These are very important measures, and the public wants to know them, and the delivery system wants them perfect. And I don't know that we'll ever get to perfect. There's flaws in the measures. There's a lack of POA. There's a question about reporting and percentage. There's the thought about, is there an alternative, better risk adjustment? How do we validate the reliability and validity of the risk adjustment so it's meaningful and actionable? So all those, to me, are gaps. We want that. Now, given these measures that are there, are there measures within these three that are the interim measures we should consider until the gaps are closed? Or are these measures not of the caliber to be there? And I'm hearing the room is split. So, Bill?
I would say, to answer your question, I don't know. I don't have the information. We have not gone through a thorough process of looking at all the specs, getting all the information, how he was able to get some, others were able to get some. I don't think we're constituted to evaluate the scientific use validity of these measures. Some people have more expertise than I do and may feel like they can make that judgment, but I don't feel like I can say whether these are good enough or not. These, as you say, I think we all agree, these are really important measures. They're important from everyone's perspective. No one wants people to die as a result of complication in hospitals. We need to measure these right. We need to publish the information.
I've relied on the effectiveness of the NQF endorsement process. But I understand they're human beings and there are data limitations and some things might not be good enough measures. Many of you have raised methodological concerns or at least questions that are very appropriate. And I think we should make sure that these are good measures. But I don't know if they're – I don't have a way of judging whether that process was good enough, whether what the specs are, and we don't have – we're not set up here to go through that whole process. If we don't report these out or don't recommend these, this is an enormous gap, maybe the biggest gap in all the things we've been talking about in the last day and a half. This is very important, and if the judgment is made some way that these measures are not good enough for various reasons, then, like, holy cow, this is a giant gap. I'm sorry I can't answer your question about whether these
are bigger than your other Trump card.
I didn't know about this.
Only get one.
People raise it.
Get one now. It's close.
But, anyway, I think we would agree. These are important measures, as you yourself said. So if we for some reason decision made because of methodological flaws, these we shouldn't recommend them out. That leaves a giant gap. I think that's. I would think most people would agree with that.
Richard.
And I would agree with the statement that we don't know. And we might have 352 and 53 might be terrific measures. We just don't know whether they are. And I don't expect to have a statistic of one, which is perfect. You perfectly classified. Nothing is perfect. But I would like to know if it's 0.5, which means we can flip a coin, right? So we do need, I think we need that piece of information before we can decide.
Barbara?
Sorry, I agree that these are really important numbers. I'm concerned about what they tell you. And, mortality in the hospital is relatively uncommon. So I think they'll be very good to identify outliers, to identify places where care is really bad, and we need to know that. The public needs to know that. But to differentiate between mediocre institutions, which is most of the ones in the place from which I come, is, I think, almost impossible. You know, I don't think that there's ways to provide values, you know, ranking scales, ratios, percentages, rates that will tell you that A is better than B is better than C, but we know that D is really dreadful. And knowing that D is really dreadful is very important. So I'm very concerned about how we calibrate this message.
Sorry, I keep digging into PSI-4. One of the things I want to note is that, I'm not sure if everybody knows, but PSI-4 is actually publicly reported right now by CMS in the IQR program. So that data is out there right now on the hospitals. The other thing I'm looking at, too, is that, I have this question regarding the risk adjustment that's used. I'm looking at the technical spec. Looks like they use several different age stratifications, several different types of MDRGs, several different types of MDCs, whether the patient is a transfer into the hospital. There are several comorbidities that are used. It looks like about 15 or so. And the C statistic, if it helps, is 0.737. So in the middle of the road between 0.5 and 1, if that helps.
Not bad. Helen?
I have a question. I mean, if these measures have been around for a couple of years and the ARC one is actually being reported, don't we have a way of assessing their performance from their history?
I don't have the data. I'm sure. Are they coming up for review?
So they were just reviewed in the surgery project in 2010 that just finished this year. It was a multi-phase project. It was rather large. So they did have the information on the current use of the measures. They had some historical on the use and the actual rates. They were provided reliability and validity testing that they did evaluate. All of that was before the committee, and it did pass. And when I read through, I kind of scanned through the committee's discussions of it, one of their biggest things was they wanted to have the measures harmonized as much as possible, because they're not quite yet. Beyond that, the president on admission, from what I can tell, did not actually come up as an issue, which is interesting, because it's a major topic of discussion today, but it did not. I think in part it was just these measures have been in use a long time, and I don't think that question had just came up with that committee. But.
So measure maintenance looked at performance of the measure and reported, was that where the report came from on the C statistic?
So when I look at what they provided, I don't see the C statistic, but they also provide different, sometimes they will provide different types of testing to us that then they have additional that they will present on their website. So that's why, again, there may be a bit of a discrepancy, which I'm glad Lance found out.
Yeah, I'm looking at the latest version of our software, which is 4.4. So the technical specs are from 2012, and the C statistic is listed on the bottom of the risk adjustment coefficient tables. Right. That's where I found it. Just to be clear.
So, you know, the acceptable C statistic at the endorsement process is 0.7.
Well, we don't actually have.
We break it out into ranges.
Right, but the testing task force that looked at this came forward with a recommendation that they could not come up with a set threshold, and it was very dependent on what the type of measure we were looking at, all of that. So most typically look at 0.7, but there's no set threshold.
Richard?
Maybe overly arcane, but looking at the C statistic as the C statistic of the model, is how good is that model that they built at classifying the data? But it's not looking at the characteristics of the test. How good is the test if we've got a chart in front of us and we want to decide was this a true complication or not? So I don't know if that test has really been done. So, knowing that there's a good risk adjustment model does help. It makes me feel better. It does misclassify one out of every four patients, right? So, in either direction. So, in one out of four times, I would have a complication. It will claim that I had a complication and I didn't, or it will let me sail by and I did have a complication.
But the grade is still good.
It's good if you're going to do internal improvement. I don't know if I want to be judged by it.
Andrea?
So I've been listening to all of the arguments, and like Bill, I don't really feel qualified to make a recommendation or a judgment on one of these three. I'm trying to channel Suzanne Del Banco because I'm sure she would have some passionate position here. I think I fall in the camp of if all we identify here at the end of the day is a gap and we don't actually endorse a measure, then we've failed. So I know I agree with Richard across the table that it is like the adverse drug events, that this is, we can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And none of these are perfect, but if we only identify gaps and not identify a measure here, then I think we've really done a disservice to the, and I agree that we want a number to be accurate. If it's going to be publicly reported, there are, we could go back and forth on this all day long, but that's
okay. So, no more cards. It's time to get serious. We haven't done this all day, and so we get to do it now. What we're going to do is we're going to look at these three. We're going to pick a best in breed, and we're going to just get a vote.
And if we don't have consensus, then we will go back and dig up whatever we can find. And in the interim, try and get back to you. But I'm looking at the three that are here. We've got public reporting on the one, the ARC measure, with a revisit of all three measures through the surgical project, and basically a re-endorsement through the measure maintenance process of all three measures. So they've been through endorsement rigorously and put forward. So I'm asking you, on these three, is there one best in breed that we're going to put forward? Or I'd like one best in breed, and then we'll see if we want to add the other two, we can. If we want to add all three, I'm okay, but then let's vote. We won't be setting precedent because we'll be done. Richard?
I would like to know how the other two compare to the ARC, and we don't know that. We simply don't. Therefore, I would have to vote for the ARC because it's what we use now, and at least I know something about the model. I may be voting for an inferior measure, but I can't support a measure when I don't know anything about its operating characteristics.
I think that's a great point. And you know, we will come back to you with data based on no matter what the vote turns out to be, but so that we have more informed decisions. If we have to pull back and reconsider, we can. Andrea?
I was just going to start the voting. 351.
Okay.
Power measure.
Randy?
I was just going to ask him, don't you think 5.2 and 5.3 go together? As one.
As bundle.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. And I would not want to cast the net as narrow as just surgery. And I recognize these.
They are just surgery. They're all just surgery.
Two and three
are just surgery.
They're just surgery?
These are all three of these are just surgery measures. But I think you're right. I think it's voting for 51 or voting for a bundle 52-53. I think there's the question even the group had, the review group has endorsement. It said it's time to harmonize. So it's time for us to get parsimonious. Richard?
Yeah, I would vote 351.
All right. Well, so I'm hearing nomination for 351. And we'll vote for the other two and see where everyone stands as a bundle for those. So all those in favor of 351. Okay. Anybody on the phone wish to vote? All right. All those in favor of the bundle 352-53. So we will push forward with 351. We will go back and see what available information we have that might be of value to you and bring that back to you. But at least we're not walking out of here and walking away from this. And we I think, have captured the gap here very, very well. Let me just flip to the last two, which 531, 532. And we criticized these yesterday. Is there a burning need to move these forward? Bill?
I just want to ask a question. I haven't been keeping score about all the ones that are in these composites, but my vague memory from 24 hours ago was that we did like some of these, not all of them. So does someone
we
have
picked them up as individuals, but we did not pick them up as a composite.
I'm sorry. I thought we said, could someone just clarify, what do we do with these when we address them yesterday as individuals? Do we accept them all, reject them all, or mix?
Who's the mix? Was not? we don't have that in front of us. It's a mix.
Okay, so that's helpful.
That was the problem with looking at these as composites. We had said no to some of them as individuals and bringing those negatives back into the composite.
And it helped also why we rejected them. The ones that we did reject, was it because they just weren't as important, or because there was some methodological problem, or something else? I don't know.
There's a whole host of reasons. Some of them there were not safety, some of them there was claim space, some of them was just reliability of the measures. There was not a clear consistency. There were different reasons that when we looked at them. But we can pull that out specifically and bring that back so that we understand that for these measures.
The reason I ask is I can imagine that there might have been some on an individual basis that when we're trying to pare a list down from 14 down to 3, we said, this one, maybe not as important. It's a good measure, but doesn't get in the top 3. I can imagine, you know, in a composite, it's okay to include that. Even though we, quote, rejected it yesterday, it wasn't for it because it wasn't a flaw in the measure. It wasn't a, claim space and miscoding problems or something like that. So that's the reason I ask. I could imagine supporting them as part of a composite, even if we didn't include them yesterday.
So can we leave? I think we need to answer the question you're asking, but we're not going to answer it today. Let's just leave these and figure out what that answer is for these components of this composite. Fair enough. Yeah.
One more question about this. The pediatric measure, do we really – it seems to me that we've been pretty light on pediatric all the way through, and that this might be a significant pediatric measure.
Again, for the same reason, let's bring back the information of what we had from yesterday. We'd be inconsistent if we didn't do that. So we'll leave both of these on the table and get back to you with the details of the composite. My team is up. So we have some discussions about these gap areas that has been work that's been ongoing about how to identify these gaps and how to fill these gaps and where this is going outside the scope of our endorsed measures, but those things that are in the pipeline. And we've got two guests who have been kind to come here, and I'm sorry we're late, but the group has been moving through this, trying to get through some very complex discussions today, so our apologies for doing that. And so please welcome Aaron Giovanetti and Mark Antman, and I think is Aaron going to you first?
Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for inviting me to come here and tell you a little bit about the work that we're doing at NCQA around safety measures. I'm Erin Giovanetti. I'm a research scientist with NCQA, and my background is in gerontology and geriatric medicine. So apologize in advance if this has the slant towards the older population, but they are my favorite. So I was asked to give a very high-level overview of what's our measure development process. And I apologize, this is very small text, but I'm trying to cover something that takes, a year to 2 years to develop a measure. And that's just to go from measure concept to a measure that we think is good enough to start putting in the field, but doesn't involve any of the work that comes after that with revising it. But we start with environmental scans of what's in the field already, guidelines, evidence review. We review that with our measurement advisory panels to get input on how should we prioritize measure concepts. We often come up with many more measure concepts than we have time to act or resources to actually develop measures. We then start to draft the specification of what the measure would look like. We bring that back to our advisory panel and we say, does this our specification, how we think we should measure this concept, match what you think. Once we get a good measure specification, we do field testing. usually since NCQA generally develops measures for health plans, usually the field testing is in a health plan setting, although we also develop measures for providers and hospitals. So depending on the setting, the measure determines what type of environment we do the field testing in. We review the results with our measurement advisory panel. We have public comment. We review the results again. We revise. We go back to the measurement advisory panel. A lot of kind of iterative processes here to make the perfect measure, come up with a finalized measure. And I think the main point here is that this takes a while because we don't want to put anything into the field that's not well thought out and every possible implication of the measure hasn't been evaluated. We have our own desirable measure criteria, which you'll notice are very similar to the NQF measure criteria for evaluation. One thing that's a little different is that we do focus on auditability because all of our measures, all HEDIS measures are audited. So we need to make sure that we do go in and that this is a measure that we can make sure people are implementing appropriately. Another thing that we spend a lot of time thinking about has to do with the setting of measurement. While it would be really great if we had a unified healthcare system where we could have the same measure in every single setting, it doesn't work that way right now because we don't have shared accountability across settings for patient care. And right now we still have measures that relate to hospitals, measures that relate to providers, measures that relate to health plans. And there are certain considerations that need to go into measures when you're determining what is the eligible population for these different levels of analysis. So, for example, if you are having a measure that looks at providers, you can only include patients who went to see a provider. You can't hold providers accountable for patients they never saw. Conversely, if you're looking at the health plan, you can include all members in that health plan, regardless of whether or not they went to see a provider. Another example is looking at, like, a hospital. You can hold a hospital accountable for things that happened in the hospital, but you can't hold them accountable for things that might have happened when the patient left the hospital. So especially when you get into these questions around care coordination measures, it's difficult to create these measures that, let's say you want a medication reconciliation that says the doctor at the hospital looked at the medication list, they gave it to the patient, they talked to the doctor, the outpatient or the primary care provider, they communicated, they reconciled the medication list, that's great. The hospital is going to say, we have no control over what the primary care doctor does. So we just have to be aware of that we still have these silos in healthcare and that measurement still needs to be respectful of those silos in order for it to actually be implemented and used. And then another thing we think about is priority data sources. So two of the data sources we're really trying to expand our measurement in is patient-reported data and data that comes from electronic health records. But keeping in mind that while electronic health records are the future, they're not widespread, and not everyone has them, and that we still need to have measures of quality for the 80% of practices that don't have usable electronic health records for collecting quality data. So where are we focusing when it comes to safety? NCQA is really trying to focus on the ambulatory care setting and safety measures that can be that have to do with practices in ambulatory care. We have colleagues at different measure developers who are really great at developing hospital safety measures, nursing home safety measures, et cetera, and we leave that to them. But we really like to focus on ambulatory care. So what are some existing measures? Well, you've seen some of these in the map, the work that you've been doing. We have a use of high-risk medication in the elderly measure, potentially harmful drug-disease interactions in the elderly, annual monitoring for patients on persistent medications, falls risk screening, assessment, and plan of care, which I believe you looked at yesterday, measures of medication reconciliation and review, and then a measure of plan all-cause readmission. Some measures that are under development. We are developing a measure to look at adverse drug events as they relate to use of blood thinners. We're working on a measure of potentially avoidable hospitalizations based off of the ARC population quality indicators.
We're also looking at overuse measures based off of the Choosing Wisely guidelines that came out. So those are just some of the areas where we are focusing our energy. Now to some of the challenges that we encounter. You know, there's really some typical challenges that everybody says, you know, there's no money for measurement development, there's, you know, no data source, et cetera. So I tried to focus on some of the ones that I think don't often get brought up. We deal a lot with evidence base for vulnerable populations that really need good quality measures. There's no evidence base specifically focused on those populations. Here I'm referring to people with multiple chronic conditions, children, and the elderly. A lot of clinical trials and guidelines exclude these populations because they're more difficult and they're more complex. And then this leaves us in a tough place when we're trying to develop measures. And we can only say, well, should we exclude them because they never actually studied them in a randomized controlled trial? But yet this is a population where it's really important and we need to have guidelines and we need to have measures for it. Another one is that all the low-hanging fruit is gone. We've done the easy stuff, and now we're stuck with a lot of the really hard measures. And so moving forward, I think while when NCQA first got started, we got a lot of measures, bam, 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 out of the gate. But there's a lot of stuff that's left that needs measuring. It's really hard to measure. And so we just need to be it's just going to take a lot more effort. Small numbers of rare events make comparisons between entities really difficult, especially in the safety world when we deal with, so for example, I'm looking at the potentially avoidable hospitalizations rate. And when you look down at each individual condition, what you find is that a lot of these in a health plan setting, you might find a health plan that 1 year had two in this particular, you know, condition, let's say, amputation of a limb, and another health plan that had four. So when you compare those two health plans, it looks like one health plan had double the rate, but it's really just two more additions. And so when you're dealing with these small numbers, it really it becomes more difficult in terms of how do you interpret differences and whether or not you think those differences that you see are actual valid differences in the quality of care being provided. So that's just one of the things we struggle with. Risk adjustment for outcomes to ensure comparisons are fair. You guys just went over this, how really hard this is. And there's been a lot of push for outcome measures, but outcome measures do need to be risk adjusted. And there's a lot of debate about what's the appropriate, how do you appropriately risk adjust things. Also, risk adjustment is not the same on different levels of accountability. You don't use the same risk adjustment when you're comparing providers versus when you're comparing health plans because there are different things that may come up when you're comparing providers, different things that you need to control for that may not be factors in your controlling health when you're comparing health plans. There's a lot of unintended consequences of measurement. So one thing that we most recently dealt with in our measure that was looking at potentially harmful medications in the elderly is that this can affect coverage decisions. We had to be very aware that if we put a measure into this list, it's not uncommon that a pharmacy benefit or formulary will say, oh, this medication is on the avoid list. We're not going to cover this anymore. Whereas when we look at a measure, we're saying these are potentially inappropriate medications in the elderly, but we leave it to the clinicians to decide when it's the right time to prescribe one of these medications. And we certainly don't mean for, you know, it's the case that quality measures do end up coming down to payment decisions, but that's not the original intent. And we just need to be conscious of the fact that these are decisions that will be made and we have no control over them. Also, there's a possibility of creating disincentives to provide appropriate care. So I know this came up with the falls discussion. If you start to measure, to compare entities based off of the number of falls, does this provide an incentive to just keep your population immobile? Because that's the best way to prevent falls. And so, or does it create an incentive to not report falls or to not accurately follow up with patients about whether they fall? So these are just some of the things that we think about. And then finally, resource intensive. We need to prioritize where in a given year our focus goes because a lot of these measures, particularly around risk adjustment, are very resource intensive. So after all I've described all of these challenges, I thought I'd
finish up with a success story. So kind of an example of where things really came together and we were able to, what I think, come up with a really great measure. So we've had a longstanding measure, use of high-risk medication in the elderly, that was based on the original Beers criteria. As you may or may not know, that criteria had not been updated for quite a while, and we slowly modified it on a drug-by-drug basis over the years without a solid evidence base. Last year, the American Geriatric Society formed a panel to update the Beers criteria, and they used IOM guideline development principles where they rated the evidence. They invited measure developers, specifically NCQA and the Pharmacy Quality Alliance, as non-voting members to provide the measure development perspective. And we felt this was very important because when experts, clinical experts, are making these recommendations, they may not be thinking through the implications of the words that they put into a table that then go down into a measurement decision as to whether or not you include this particular drug in the table. And so we were able to clarify with them, saying if you think you can't use words like sometimes, this is not good. You really do need to come down to clear decisions such that we can develop a quality measure out of it. And so the result was that they revised these criteria that were designed for clinical use, but we were also able to easily, and I mean nothing is easy in the measurement world, but for the most part easily and timely translate that clinical guidelines into a harmonized quality measure. So the PQA measure and the NCQA measure are harmonized, but together the new measure will be coming out. It's completely up to date with the evidence. And this is really a success story for us in terms of how we can move very quickly from guidelines to a measure. And so with that, I will stop.
Thank you very much. I'm sure we're going to have some more questions and discussion on this, but let me go to Mark Antman. Mark, welcome, and thank you for making the trip.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for the invitation, and delighted to have a chance to talk about what the PCPI has done in this area. I unfortunately did not have limited time to prepare my slides for this meeting, so you'll see when we go to my slides that I focus primarily on specific measure topics, but let me talk for a few minutes sort of framing my comments around the some of the issues that that Aaron touched on. First of all, let me orient you, for those of you who are unfamiliar with PCPI work, to measure development by the PCPI. The PCPI, as I think you can say see in the fine print at the top of this slide, stands for Physician Consortium for Performance Improvement. It's convened by the American Medical Association, and it was originally convened to develop measures for physicians, for physician-level quality improvement and accountability. Over the 12 years, roughly, that the PCPI has been developing measures, the work has evolved from exclusively developing measures for physicians to developing measures for physicians and other clinicians as well. And it has now evolved to not only developing measures purely for accountability or for use at the clinician level, but sometimes for use at higher levels, at facility levels, at group level. Ideally, we're moving towards measures that can be used at ACO level. And as far as process goes, as far as the process of developing measures, Aaron talked about the NCQA process, which I would say is mirrored very closely by the PCPI process of developing measures. It includes reviewing the evidence base, it includes convening an expert panel, doing public comments, testing the measures, finalizing, revising the measures based on public comments collected. The most significant difference, I would say, in the process that the PCPI has followed over the years is that whereas NCQA does field testing fairly early in the process, generally the PCPI has finalized its measures and then tested them. So in other words, we do public comment when the measures are still in draft form. We go back to our development group, try to finalize the measures, and then we test them after that. That, I will say, has complicated things a little bit for us in bringing measures to the National Quality Forum, in that we have to wait until the measures are finalized, then test them. So that does create a little bit of a time lag for us in bringing measures forward to the NQF for endorsement. So before we get to individual topics, let me talk a little bit about what the PCPI approach has been to identifying areas in which we should be developing measures over the years. And again, as I said, our initial focus was to develop measures for use by physicians. And so we let the evidence guide us, and primarily we worked on topics where the evidence was strongest, and we began logically on a very condition-focused approach, working on those topics for which quality improvement and accountability at the physician level was realistic to measure and achievable, and where the evidence was strongest. So we began in areas such as cardiovascular care, diabetes, asthma, et cetera. Those topics, those clinical topics where the evidence is strongest, where there are known interventions that work. Early on, we began to, we were fortunate that we were contracted by CMS to also develop measures for physicians, but to develop measures specifically for their quality reporting programs that CMS was beginning to implement. And in so doing, in being contracted by CMS to focus on those reporting programs, we were asked to develop measures for specific specialties that were lacking measures. So consequently, over the years, we have moved from specialty to specialty looking for specialties that were lacking measures and making a concerted effort to be sure that every physician specialty has measures that they can use. And I think we've more or less achieved that now. There may be one or two specialties that have very few measures, but that was the approach that we took. And so that's by way of saying that we have never really focused on specific patient safety areas in developing measures. Rather, we have worked on a topic-by-topic and specialty-by-specialty approach, and along the way developed many safety measures for individual topics, many of which were in the list that I think you've reviewed for the last day and a half. Most recently, I will say that, and I'll quote the line that Aaron used a few minutes ago, all the low-hanging fruit is gone, and that is very true. And more recently, we have been, based on feedback from PCPI members and based on other constituents of the PCPI, we have realized that we need to focus more energy to overuse. And so that, I know, is well within the patient safety framework that you've been discussing. So a lot of what you see that I'll be talking about on a specific measure level is related to overuse. But we've also been focusing more on outcome measures. Over the 10 or so years that the PCPI has been developing measures, the vast, vast majority of them are process measures because, as you know, our outcome measures are much tougher to develop. And I'll say that most recently, the PCPI identified several specific topics for which they were targeting the development of overuse measures. Beyond those specific topics, we now, with every new work group that we convene, we ask them to look for opportunities to develop overuse measures as well as to develop develop outcomes. So with that intro, actually I have the controller, don't I? Here we go. Okay. So I mentioned that there were some specific topics that we identified a couple of years ago now, in which we specifically wanted to target overuse measures. And you can see the list here. I won't read that for you. But I'll go through these. And so what I've done in this presentation is I've taken each of these topics, and I'm going to give you an update on the overuse measures that we have succeeded in developing for several topics that are far enough along that I can report on them. A few of these topics are still early enough in the process that I can at least tell you what we're thinking about. but unfortunately I don't have specific measures that I can report on. And I believe that many, if not all, of the specific measures that I'm focusing on are measures that I don't think are on your lists of overuse or inappropriate use measures that you've been reviewing. In maternity care, these measures were recently approved by the PCPI. We worked with both ACOG and NCQA on these measures. And the final set of measures that came out recently included three overuse measures on these topics. I've given you the specific measure descriptions for those three measures on the chance that that you may want to look at these specifically. And again, I have the disadvantage of not having heard your discussion over the last day and a half, but if these happen to fill some gaps that you've identified within within obstetrical care, I wanted you to have the full information there. Now, this slide is here so that I can emphasize a point that I haven't made yet, which is that, or that I've alluded to, I suppose, and that is that in each measure development project, the PCPI has encouraged work groups to develop a comprehensive set of measures, to not just be looking at overuse measures or not just be looking at outcome measures, but to also be looking at process measures and look at a full comprehensive set of measures that address as many aspects of care and as many gaps in care as possible in the individual topic. So the intent here in the yellow in the middle of the slide, you can see there are the three overuse topics specified, but you can see across the rest of the slide there are various process measures as well as outcome measures identified as well. And that was my attempt to highlight those overuse measures for you. All right. In PCI, percutaneous coronary intervention, this is a project that was launched last year sometime. We've had some delays with this project, and it is not complete yet, but I will tell you that we are working on a measure for elective PCI, a measure currently titled Indication for Elective PCI, the intent being to focus on those circumstances where elective PCI is clearly overused. Because of the challenges of clearly identifying those circumstances in which elective PCI is indicated, we have, quite frankly, had some struggles with this measure, but we're hoping that it will be available to share with you and with others fairly soon. Hitting the wrong buttons here. Here we go. Sinusitis is the topic that is close enough to completion that I feel that I can tell you information on specific topics. Again, I don't believe specific measures, that is. I'm fairly certain that none of these measures were submitted to NQF and the MAP, and so none of them were on any of your lists. These currently and again, these six measures that I've listed on the slide are part of a much larger set of, I think, perhaps 10 to 12 measures. But these are the overuse measures that have been identified at this point, three of them in the imaging area and three related to antibiotics. And the status of these measures, I still mentioned them as draft on this slide. They're currently in process for an approval vote by the PCPI intended to conclude later this month, so on the fairly safe assumption that after the thorough process that we've gone through in developing and vetting these measures, the assumption that they will be approved, I'm sharing them with you here. So these are the three measures that we hope will be finalized shortly and made available in the imaging area. Plain film radiography for acute sinusitis, CT for acute sinusitis, and more than one CT within 90 days for acute sinusitis, all areas that have been identified as overuse areas that our work group felt needed to be addressed. And these are the three overuse areas related to antibiotics, again, associated with acute sinusitis. Again, all these measures will hopefully, I expect, will be publicly available fairly soon. So other topics that we're working on currently, the other topics that have specifically focused on developing overuse measures our cardiac diagnostic imaging, and you'll see immediately after this the non-cardiac diagnostic imaging group. Thus far, there are three overuse measures that have been developed. These actually were previously developed by some of our partners listed, ACC and AHA. And if I'm not mistaken, I think these are actually already endorsed by the NQF, and so these may have been on your lists in one place or another. But the ACC and AHA brought these through the PCPI, looking for opportunities to enhance them, looking to vet them more broadly. So these are under consideration by the PCPI. They are not as yet finalized, so I haven't given you more details on these measures. I think they are being modified somewhat from the versions that the ACC and AHA originated. And the non-cardiac diagnostic imaging group that I already mentioned is earlier in their process. Rather than list any topics that we're working on, I have instead listed a number of non-cardiac imaging measures that we already reviewed as part of our environmental scan and beginning that work. I think many, if not all of these, were on your lists for review. So obviously we are looking for non-cardiac diagnostic imaging topics above and beyond those that have already been dealt with the measures that you see here. And this is not an exhaustive list of the non-cardiac imaging measures that already exist. Back pain management was another area that we identified as one that we were targeting for the development of overuse measures, but I'll skip to the bottom of the slide here, and you'll see that I've said on hold, uncertain need for additional measures. Quite frankly, as we did our environmental scan, it was clear to us that there are already a great many measures on overuse of imaging for back pain management, some of which are, many of which listed here are NCQAs. And quite frankly, we've not yet identified a measure gap in this area, and we may not do so. So right now, we're not proceeding with developing measures for back pain management. Another project that we have in progress is a measure development group that was originally referred to as radiation dose optimization. Recently, we revised it to be describing more accurately the intent to be focusing on optimizing patient exposure to ionizing radiation. Right now, there is the appropriateness measure or overuse measure that you see listed on this slide, follow-up CT imaging for incidental pulmonary nodules according to recommended guidelines. There may be other overuse measures that will be forthcoming from that group as well. And then beyond this, and I won't go through these in detail because I just thought I'd list some of the other topics. The first one listed here, atopic dermatitis, that's still a draft overuse measure that's in development. But all the other topics that I've listed on this slide and subsequent slides are all topics for which the measures are complete and I believe were on the list that you've reviewed in the last couple of days. And it includes these other topics that I've listed here as well. So as far as, and this is just another slide to illustrate the, for acute adult kidney disease, the fact that the measures that we developed, are in the context of trying to address patient safety, trying to address overuse, but also looking for outcome measures. In this case, the three kidney disease measures that were overuse measures were structured as outcome measures as well. But again, they're part of a much larger set that includes a number of process measures as well. I'll actually go back to the slide where I listed the kidney disease measures. I'm fairly certain, even though these were approved last year, I don't think that these were part of the information that we submitted to NQF and the MAP for inclusion in the MAPS discussions of measures. So I don't think these those three measures listed, two catheter use measures and the other related to ESA therapy for patients with chronic kidney disease, I don't think these were on the MAP lists either. So I think I'll stop there. I could talk a little bit about the challenges that we've encountered in developing safety or overuse-related measures, but quite frankly, they're very similar to those that Aaron listed, so I don't think that would necessarily provide you with more information. But I'm happy to answer questions and discuss further.
Well, thank you very much. That's a lot of work on your plate that we can see, and we're hoping to add to it.
All right.
Because we had lots of issues that we talked about today that we wanted the code to do this or do that or do that or do this. But before we go there, Laura and I know Kevin have been working a lot in bringing forth measures. So I'm just wondering, Laura, do you have any additions to add on now? And
We're a little different than, I think, different structure than AMA, PCPI, and NCQA. We, as a consensus-based entity, actually use the National Quality Strategy Plan as our roadmap. So within PQA, we have a series of work groups, and each work group closely aligns with one of the priorities. So we have a patient safety work group and a little twist to care coordination. We have a medication reconciliation work group, an overuse work group, a population health work group. And we develop measures mostly for two audiences, health plans, and the measures that we develop for health plans are often incorporated into the CMS Star Ratings program for Medicare Part D. And we also develop pharmacy measures, so measures of comprehensive medication review, medication therapy management, those types of measures. We follow a similar process, I think, to the NCQA and PCPI. We have a technical expert panel. I think the only other difference that we've had is in our initial, we're only a seven-year organization. So for the first couple of years, we partnered with NCQA, which did a lot of the field testing for our measures. But now we have over 90 members, many of which are health plans. So we often partner with our health plans to actually do the field testing of our measures using their data. And that's proven to be a pretty efficient pathway for us, both from a cost standpoint and from a resource standpoint. And then the measures that come out of PQA, we often do look for the opportunities to submit them to NQF for endorsement, but CMS will use them within the Medicare Part D program if they are endorsed by PQA's membership through a very open and transparent process. So we bring measures to our membership for endorsement twice yearly, once in June and once in November, and that facilitates getting them into the CMS queue, if you will, which has a long lead time in order to be incorporated into the quality measure set that they use for Medicare plans.
Thank you. Kevin?
Certainly. So my perspective is a unique one from because all we think about are e-measures. So at the Office of the National Coordinator, we oversee the clinical quality measures that go into the Meaningful Use Program. We actually have contracts to develop some of those as a subcontractor for CMS, but CMS does the majority of the contract to build for those. The other kind of unique part about the Meaningful Use Program is it's not an accountability program. It is really an infrastructure building program. So the purpose of our measures is slightly different than many other programs. Eventually, there's the idea that these measures influence value-based purchasing, but at the beginning, we can build measures that really leverage the technology but aren't used for accountability. So we've been focusing on measures that really can be used for local quality improvement. So one of our key messages is how can a hospital or provider use this measure in ideally in real time to influence and improve the care of the patients one at a time. And that's a different sort of frame for measurement than a lot of measurement, which has been historically retrospective and population-oriented and can encompass a whole variety of data sources with that sort of goal of point-of-care quality improvement. It gives us a little different filter on measurement. A couple of other things that we have had to think about, and there's a big desire to automate measures, which we fully endorse, But we have to be sure automation doesn't mean transferring a coding practice from a coder to a doctor. And so to some people, automation actually just adds burden to the point of care. And what we've had to figure out is how do we not add burden to the point of care, but really leverage the work of the point of care and their engagement to do this effectively. So sometimes measures that are built for some kind of coding workflow or chart abstraction workflow just don't work very well because they're retrospective. They require through time measurement or something that you only know at discharge. So if it requires a principal diagnosis, that's a coding idea of discharge that you can't know on admission. You just can't. You have a potential diagnosis at admission, but you don't have a principal diagnosis on admission. So we've run into issues that just mean they simply can't be specified and keep their meaning for that use. We also run into issues that they have to be deeply specified. These now need, there can no longer be ambiguity. And so we build in, we have to build definitions down to the individual codes for everything and logic models that incorporate every single node of the measure. And as we've dug through measure specifications, most of them come in a qualitative textual format and aren't specified in that computer readable format, and we run into sort of logical questions at the margins of these measures that we have to resolve with our developers. Another thing that we're really trying to figure out is a lot of the measures don't actually leverage the technology very well. If they're built for a human being to do chart abstraction from, they don't actually ask that human being to do a lot of complicated calculations because most of those people don't want to do a bunch of calculus. It turns out that computers are great at doing calculus, and it can do it really fast, and it can do it in a really complicated way. And so we can actually build measures that do complicated math and quickly and efficiently and reliably that we would never ask a human being to do retrospectively. What we have to figure out is how to do that in a way that still gives it validity and transparency and meaning, and it doesn't obscure the meaning with all that complicated calculation. As many other people have mentioned, we run into a cycle time problem. So that we'll identify something like the National Quality Strategy has a goal. We want a care coordination measure, and ideally we'd like it in a program for Meaningful Use 3. The Meaningful Use 3 rule will be written in a year, and so anything that we have that we want to put in the Meaningful Use rule, we've got to develop between now and this time next year. And to get that NQF and MAP endorsed and everything else, we're squishing a lot of stuff into one little year. But where the Meaningful Use 3 program will actually not be implemented until 2016. And so we have this problem where we have to try to condense this development cycle down to its important essential components so that we can hopefully move this forward and actually get things into programs in ways that everyone finds meaning from. I've got a lot of other thoughts, but there's probably plenty of questions and things to chew on, so those are just a few.
So there were a lot of points brought up by the committee over the last 2 days about how imperfect the measures are for our goals, and I just want to reopen the old wounds of the last 2 days from us to you, the developer side, and figure out what we need to do, sharing with you what gaps were identified. And I'm not going to mention all of them. I'm just going to highlight a few points, and perhaps we can get feedback from you on the development side about how best to proceed and how we
best.
And how we'd want to include this in our report. For example, there was a measure that dealt with the cubitus ulcer increasing, and that measure was well supported, but it was only in one clinical setting. And so now we wanted to see that measure
pushed across multiple settings. So we saw that as a gap. It was a very important measure the group liked, and they wanted to see this march across so that we could spread it across the care continuum. And we realized there's all sorts of issues there about where do you get the data, specing the data out, looking at attribution, but we've raised issues about that. There are other areas where there's great measure development, and we heard that from Laura in things like drug-to-drug interactions and comprehensive med review for polypharmacy patients. But those are sitting out in Part D, and they're not reaching across the continuity of care, particularly between MedRec on in-hospital for those people who are going out into a chronic care world and desperately need all those gaps closed. So those are just two examples that I had, or three, that I had in on my list from the group. And before I ask for responses from the developers, let me ask the rest of the committee, was there a particular area that you found, you know, that play your one trump card here about what is that key area in the gap that you want measured developers to help us solve? Richard?
The key gap for me is finding effective measures for medication reconciliation. I think that has a big impact on patient outcomes, readmissions, costs, all kinds of things.
Thank you. Did you have a comment? Okay. So it was patient goals and the clinical treatment, clinical delivery system matched the patient goals. Richard?
Yeah, this is, I'm not going to focus specifically on a specific measure, but an issue that comes up throughout the last 2 days and that relates to other issues as well. With the advent of kind of evidence-based medicine, evidence-based healthcare, whatever, the notion of measurement gets applied to a number of different places. It gets applied to program requirements and model of care. It gets applied to performance evaluation from a kind of from a continuous quality improvement perspective. It gets applied to public reporting. Gets applied to payment. And you know, what I find is the measures don't all work the same in those four areas. You can have a measure in one area, and it's a really good measure. And people tend to grab that measure and want to apply it in lots of different places, and it doesn't work, you know. So to the degree in performance measurement, you can uncouple those. I think STARS might be an example, you know, where some of that, you know, was developed under one kind of a set of assumptions, and it gets applied to payment, and it gets applied in other kinds of settings, and you get this kind of dissonance. Or you even have certain kind of measures that get applied to a program requirement in the same arena that's fundamentally different than performance evaluation. And so, you know, in terms of constructing measures, I think it's important to have clarity around, you know, what the measurement is for, so that it doesn't kind of get skewed in application. And, you know, I think risk adjustment kind of gets mixed into this, where we had lots of discussion about it doesn't fit for all populations. And I think the more you get into public reporting, the more that risk adjustment factor becomes critically important.
Bill?
I had two thoughts regarding gaps. One, from our discussion earlier today, it seemed that adverse drug events was an area where there's a pretty strong feeling around the room that had a lot of existing process measures, none of which we felt were great, and there was a real dearth of outcome measures. So that'd be an area we'd encourage developers to work on. Stepping beyond patient safety, although it who's patient safety. I would say generally we need more patient-reported outcome measures. And that's related to patient safety, but also goes, of course, much but way beyond that. Most of the measures we have are clinical measures. We're relying on claims data in hospital or in office measures. We need to find a way to get patient-reported measures, do it in a way that's reasonably efficient, but that gap as a category is a major one that we need to find a way to fill.
Anne-Marie?
I think it's how do we measure effective provider communication across the different levels of care, and how can we really look at that whole issue of communication between providers back and forth, inpatient to outpatient, et cetera, et cetera. And then also, I don't know if you can measure this, but how do we measure whether patients really understand, when we talk about medication reconciliation, do they really understand what we're trying to tell them? Do they really understand about the medication? How do we know in a way that we could then follow up further if we felt the patient really didn't get it?
Chuck, did you have something?
Yeah, but I think Anne-Marie hit it on the nose with some understanding the shared accountability part, and then also Richard with I think it was medication reconciliation, but I think Chesley also brought it up yesterday about how it's really important to understand longitudinally which components impact patient care the most and then in various settings too.
So we do to the developers who've joined us, we're at the close of our day, but we're going to give you an opportunity to respond to some of our comments here. We're preparing our report to the Measures Application Partnership Coordinating Committee. It'll include these gaps that we've identified and any thoughts that you would have guiding us about how to work better with developers in closing these gaps and how we identify those gaps, communicate them to you, work with getting them onto the rapid list of measure development. So ladies first, Erin, I'll turn to you.
Well, I will just say that I think that everything that you guys brought up was they are great, great areas to work on, and they're all areas close to my heart that I work on. In fact, the medication reconciliation is really I have dreams about medication reconciliation and how. And I would so value any input anybody has on how we can measure this in a way that doesn't add measurement burden, because we've been told, don't give me any more medical record review. You know, we don't want those. And how we can measure this and how we can really get at the aspects of medication reconciliation which are not as easily measured. So did the patient understand what happened? Did the doctor sit down and talk with the patient about why they should be taking each one of these medications? And those sorts of things, those interactions that are so important that happen in a doctor's office are very hard to get at when with the data that you have. And I can say I don't even know what the right data source would be other than, you know, video cameras in the doctor's office. And so sometimes I think that one of the mottos we have at NCQA is not to let the perfect to be the enemy of the good, in that you don't want to, you try for what you can. And what I will say with medication reconciliation is that while the measures we have are very low bar measures, I think what's most striking about them is the low rates of performance we continue to see on them. So even though it's a low bar measure, people still aren't meeting the low bar measures. And so that's an important thing to keep in mind when we talk about we want to see a measure that's really strong and really getting at it, is are people actually getting to the low bar ones? And I will also echo the patient-reported outcomes piece, I think, is so important. And what hurts me is that sometimes I come to committees with measures that are patient-reported and people say, well, you can't trust patients. You don't know if what the patient's saying is true. And I think that there needs to be a kind of attitude shift that it doesn't matter if what the patient is saying is what the physician actually did. If the patient didn't recognize that the physician did something, then something's not getting through clearly. So I would say those are the kind of the two things that I would like to see in the world of measurement, is more trust in what patients have to say on measures and more trust in those measures. And then also, sometimes a low bar measure is still getting at something that's still a quality problem. So.
Thank you very much. Mark?
Thanks, Frank. So Aaron touched on some of the topics that I wanted to touch on as well, so I won't say anything further about medication reconciliation. I think Aaron covered that very well. She also talked about patient-reported measures, and I'll add a little bit to that if I may. But, Aaron, if you don't mind, can I ask you first a quick question? You said you expressed your frustration of what happens when you bring ideas for patient-reported measures to committees. Were you referring to NQF steering committees or other committees?
I didn't want to call out NQF steering committees, but yes, NQF steering committees.
Okay. I mean, I think we may as well be honest here, and I guess I wanted to confirm that that's what you were referring to, and that mirrors our experience as well. And I guess I would encourage this group to think, to be aware of the fact that as NQF measure endorsement criteria are structured right now, we really need a completely different paradigm for patient-reported measures because, again, both NCQA and PCPI have found in bringing patient-reported measures, potential patient-reported measures to NQF, there are various criteria. There are a number of criteria where we have found that, frankly, we don't pass. And in some instances, we don't know what criteria we don't pass because we don't get through the first ones. If we don't get past impact, we can't get to performance gap, we can't get to evidence, et cetera. I do think a new paradigm is needed, and I guess I'll leave it at that for on that topic. With regard to effective provider communication and patient understanding, the PCPI clearly has recognized the need for measures in those areas. We do have a set of care transition measures that have focused on one transition from patients from being discharged from inpatient settings to other settings of care, and we focused on measures related to the communication needed from the hospital to other providers. We would like very much to focus on other topics in provider communication as well that in particular deal with patient understanding. At our first attempt in dealing with measuring patient understanding, this, of course, dovetails with the issues of patient-reported measures, right? A challenge that we have faced, completely aside from what Aaron and I have already discussed, is the fact that to implement these measures, one way of approaching them is to develop surveys that patients can complete. And we know from our limited experience in this area that in order for surveys that are developed to be readily accepted and to be and for a measure based on a survey to be either endorsed by NQF or widely accepted, it has to be a validated survey. It has to be a survey that's been tested, that's been validated through a variety of means. That frankly is a costly process, and that frankly is a discussion that frequently leads to the conclusion that, well, why don't we use surveys that are already out there? So we've had a number of work groups that have frankly thrown up their hands and said, well, what can we do with CAPS as it exists currently, and what can we get out of that? And to ARC's credit, I know they recently, not so recently anymore, a couple of years ago, introduced some health literacy questions as a supplement to the CAPS surveys. That helps a little bit. But we're still struggling, the PCPI is still struggling with getting through the process of developing surveys that are more specific to individual needs, that is, needs for getting to patient understanding for communications, to information provided to them by their physicians and other clinicians related to specific clinical topics. there is a need for validated surveys for those individual topics, and again, that's a costly process that we've not managed to undertake. So I guess that enables me to finish on the topic of, aside from development of surveys, the development of additional measures in all of the areas that you've all highlighted is an area that's in need of considerable additional funding, and that in general is lacking. So I'll stop there.
Well, I want to thank.
Please.
I'm sorry. I feel I need to follow up on the comment about patient-reported outcomes because it is such an important issue, and I also want to defend our committees a little bit because they do a good job. Patient-reported outcomes is truly something that I think everyone is trying to figure out how to handle. And in fact, we have a project that is just underway, and at the end of July, we'll meet to start looking at how do you take the individual survey results, use it, how do you then aggregate that information, what's the testing that's required for that, how do you try to get it integrated into electronic health records. All of those questions are underway because, in part, I think it's a challenge for anyone to look at it, those measures now and truly understand what is the best way to approach that. So we have work underway that will hopefully help answer the future questions that I'm sure PCPI and NCQA will be answering when they submit those measures. Thanks.
Just one related comment. I think that some of our problem sometimes comes that we only do this process for fully completed measures. I think that sometimes if we would drill down and endorse tools, so, for example, the partners group has decided to use the PROMISE tool, which is a tool of patient functional status across the whole of the partners enterprise. They're going to use that in any number of settings for any number of reasons, just like we use blood pressure across the whole enterprise for lots of different reasons. And that gives me, as a measure developer, a new tool that is already validated, that already works, that I can use over and over and over and over again. But the current process by which a fully packaged measure as a unit is the only thing that we consider makes it hard for me to reuse components in that modular way.
Well, I'm afraid we could go on with this discussion. We're opening the door, and really I think we've heard some great comments about where some barriers are, but I think there are more yet to be identified. And so I think the thoughts about looking internally or what are the barriers inside the current endorsement process, what are the barriers that are leading into calling the measures out and creating the development processes, all of those things I think are important for us to identify. And I think it, only with more experience will we identify more of the barriers and begin to take them down. I want to open up to the room first for public comments. And if I could open up to the microphone, to the telephone for public comments.
And if you would like to make a comment, please press star one. And there are no comments from the telephone line.
And to Tom, any final comments, Tom?
Well, thanks to all of you for the marathon that we've and for being the first group to actually make it through one of our topic areas for developing a family of measures. As staff, we've learned a huge amount from you all about what that could mean, and we're going to continue to refine that, and we would welcome your input into not only ongoing input, because we're not done yet with the substance of what we've done here, but also your input into the process. We're going to be repeating this with this group for care coordination, and then we're also going to be doing this for other priority areas and high-impact conditions. So thank you all for your forbearance, and particularly want to thank Frank for his leadership. This is a really tough job that he has, not only with the group in the room, but also helping keep staff in line behind the scenes. So thank you, Frank.
It's really the other way around. Connie, any comments? Heidi? Lindsay?
I just need to remind everyone that we get to do something similar in about a month. Our next meeting is on July 18th and 19th. We'll be in D.C., but we should be at NCF's offices for that meeting. As I mentioned yesterday, you should have gotten your travel memo in your email. Please let me know if you didn't. And thank you so much from me as well. It's been a pleasure.
And then finally, so many of you really did a great job today and prior to the meeting in taking your assignments on and reviewing the materials and bringing in very thoughtful comments. I actually don't think it would have worked if you hadn't done that. I think we would have been struggling to try and figure out how to get through this. So the time and effort that you put in prepping for this meeting, I think, made a huge difference. And then once you got here, drawing upon each other, and this group continues to gel, and I cannot tell you how much information you poured out. It's much more than you know. We're going to have to pull this together, and I'm not quite sure what it's going to look like. But I think there's an initial push back to you to get your reaction, because there are some holes that I think we could not possibly close in 2 days. So I ask you to be as thoughtful, and the best way I think to prepare for that is when you leave here tonight or tomorrow, sit down and write down a few of your takeaways, you know, three or four key takeaways that you want to make sure are in the report or somehow reflected so that you don't forget them when you get to the report. And then you'll have that when you get to the report, and you can look at it and say, you know, are those key things that I think we discussed, did we capture them? I took those notes throughout the day, and I'm going to keep these because it's so rich with what you said. I want to, again, thank all of you, thank those in the public and those who've waited on the phone all day. I hope we captured as much of your thoughts as we possibly could, and I want to wish everybody safe travels, and I'll see you soon. Andrea? Probably something similar.
We'll do our best.
Thanks again.